not only do my kids not know how to use computers, but they all, because they don't know how to use computers, they don't know how to fix things on computers. Like, they don't even have, they've never had to fix anything on a computer. It's like, how do you learn how to fix crap on computers? Like, because when we were kids, our parents didn't know anything, so there was no one to ask. And you had to just figure it out yourself.
Yeah, we just kind of broke everything and figured out how to fix it. That's basically how we figured this all out.
My son had a problem recently where he was like, Dad, the computer only types capital letters. And so I came over and he was like in a Google document. And he's like, look, capital letters, and it's not caps lock, because cap lock light on or off, either way, it just produces capital letters, right? And that was it. That was the extent of his debugging. Like, he knew cap locks existed, and he had tried toggling it on and off, and it confirmed that in one position the light is on, in one position the light is off, but either way, capital letters come out. But that was it. He was out of ideas. And that's not good.
What was it, like a stuck shift key?
So I tried another application, which is the first thing you try. Is this just Google Docs or the browser, or is it everywhere? So open text edit. Sure enough, only capital letters in text edit, right? So I'm like the things you learn from a lifetime of debugging are things that could potentially solve this problem, you know? So log out, right? We go to log out or, you know, switch users.
The master troubleshooting step. Turn everything off, turn everything back on.
And the login screen, I went to log into my account. And when you see the little password thing, you see the little arrow that tells you that things cap locks is on, you know?
Yep.
That puts in, right, and so basically it was like the computer thought caps lock was on all the time. It wasn't. You could look at the keyboard and it doesn't matter if the light was on or off, but the computer was totally convinced the caps lock was on or off. So I unplugged the keyboard and plugged it back in, and that fixed it. And then my son said to me, how could unplugging the keyboard and plugging it back in fix it? And I was like, if you've ever fixed anything on a computer, this fixes a surprising number of things. Log out and back in, unplug and replug, reboot, turn everything off, wait 10 seconds, unplug it from the wall, wait 10 seconds. All these things have reasons behind them, but like, even if you don't know the reasons behind them, eventually you learn by fixing things that sometimes you just have to do crap like that. And the only way you learn that is by actually fixing problems in the real world without understanding why they fix. You just like, what can I do to make this problem go away? And once it works for you once, it's in your bag of tricks of like, just, you know, that general idea of start the thing over again, unplug it and plug it back in, disconnect it and reconnect it. And my kids don't even have that. They don't even have the basics. They don't have any understanding of that because they've never had to fix anything themselves. So I'm like nightmares of like them leaving the house and living on their own as an adult and having a job and calling me and saying, I can't watch my TV show. It's not working. Like, because, you know, like Netflix is broken or something.
I feel like this might be kind of how like, whenever anything breaks about our house, usually, you know, if it's not that critical that it gets fixed, you know, like there isn't water pouring all over everything and we're not like installing a fire hazard outlet in the wall, but, you know, if there's, you know, like some, like, you know, we have to like hang something that's kind of heavy duty on the wall somewhere, or we have to like fix something that's made of wood, you know, usually those tasks just accumulate until my father-in-law comes to visit. He will basically just go around the first days here and just like fix everything around the house that we've been putting off forever. And I feel like maybe the way that he thinks about it, or at least the way he should think about how we seem to be totally incapable of fixing these things ourselves, might be the same way that you are thinking about, like, how can your son possibly not know how to troubleshoot these computer issues himself?
So I'm going to show up at his house when he's an adult and it's like, oh, thank God you're here. We haven't been able to watch TV in 6 months.
Maybe.
We can't figure out why, and I'm going to go up to his television, unplug it from the wall, plug it back in, and go, there you go.
That very well might be how this generation plays out.
Oh, my word. I feel the same way, though. Like, I can't think of a specific example other than my fire hazard plug that isn't actually a fire hazard, but there are plenty of things that either my dad, who is very electrically inclined, or Aaron's dad, who in a prior life was a carpenter, so he's like woodworking inclined. There's many things that without them, I would have to either pay someone to do something, maybe figure it out myself in the spare time I don't feel like I have, or just live with it forever.
I don't feel that incapable for home repair things. It's my parents do. My father does come and fix everything exactly like you were saying. Your father-in-law comes to do, Marco. But it's not because I don't know how to fix it. It's because I don't want to fix it. I don't have time to fix it. And he's going to do a better job, too, because he's fixed it more times than me. But I do know what to do, Only because I spent an entire lifetime watching Home Improvement television shows.
Oh, I spent a lot of time watching those, not as much as you, but I spent a lot of time watching those shows too. So all I can do is be the annoying person of like, are you sure you want to do it that way? Like, I can be like that guy, which is the worst possible role
Nobody
to play.
Nobody likes that guy.
Yeah, no, because like I know just enough to be able to like criticize and make stupid comments about something, but not enough to actually do it right myself or to realize what that the way they did it is actually correct, not my amateur view of what Holmes on Holmes would think is the right thing to do.
You got to keep watching them, though. Like, I still have season passes for those shows. I still watch them. So then you're up to date on the latest technologies.
The latest mold generation technologies?
Criticizing and making snarky comments, whatever it is you said, isn't that pretty much our show in a nutshell? Just criticizing from afar, not really knowing what we're talking about?
But I like to think that we at least... I think we know more about what we criticize on this show than I know about home repairs.
Yes, I would say that's definitely the case. Because at the very least, all of us do a lot of things related to the things we're talking about, whereas despite me watching home improvement shows for my entire life, I've never built a house, not even once.
All right, so we should start, as always, with some follow-up. And somebody, I think John, phrased this section as pouring cold water on Apple USB-C notions. And so we talked last episode about whether or not the forthcoming iPhone, we'll call it for the purposes of this conversation, the iPhone 8, whether the phone itself will have a USB-C port on it. And there was a Wall Street Journal report that seemed ambiguously to say yes. And then Ming-Chi Kuo has come out and said, well, we believe all three new iPhones launching in the second half of 2017 will support fast charging by the adoption of Type-C power delivery technology while still retaining the Lightning port. So probably sticking with the Lightning port, which I think I'm in support of, but having listened to most of the shows that are like ours that cover this sort of thing, I feel like I'm the only one, which makes me wonder if I'm just the old man of the crowd all of a sudden.
I was hoping this was a reaction to the Wall Street Journal story, which was weird and ambiguous and had everyone talk about USB-C. And then Ming-Chi Kuo just says, no. Here, I know how to speak in sentences that have meaning that is clear to the reader. Every single new iPhone coming this year will have a Lightning port on the bottom. Boom, done. And so I'm hoping it is just simply a clarification. I'm hoping what it's not is like a competing rumor of, you know, without any particular foundation, but it certainly seemed like that ambiguous story was out there. There was a lot of chatter, and then this thing came and just shut everybody up and said, it's the boring thing. Never mind.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I think Ming-Chi Kuo needs to evolve into just the Dalrymple, just nope. Yep. No, but I think, you know, as we said last show, we all thought this was fairly unlikely to be the case, that they would replace the Lightning port with the USB-C port. I do think it is still worth considering as a thought experiment. I do think that if they were to actually like get drunk and do this, I would actually welcome that change. I think it would be temporary pain, but long term it would be great. And Apple usually errs on that side of that kind of decision. Ultimately, though, I still think it's very unlikely. With one little exception, that we keep hearing from people about the EU regulations about phones all having the same connector. And for the last few years, ever since the introduction of Lightning, basically the EU said all phones have to have, you know, what used to be micro USB. I have not honestly been following this very closely, but what I keep hearing from people is that regulation is getting more strict now, and that Apple will no longer be able to get away with just shipping an adapter that converts Lightning to USB, to micro USB, rather. Or in this case, I assume it's USB-C. So there's something going on there where the EU is putting pressure on Apple, and I don't know if they're going to be able to negotiate their way out of it again, but there might be something there. You know, like, that there might be a strong reason for Apple to say, okay, you know what, in addition to all of the other reasons we have to get rid of Lightning and switch to USB-C these days, it would also probably cause less friction with the EU and any other kind of similar regulatory body around the world that might get in the way. You know, I wouldn't expect in the next 3.5 to 7 years that the US would really care that much about reducing waste in a regulation But I imagine other countries that actually have functioning governments probably all have similar goals.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be awesome, right? They probably all have similar goals of, like, you know, reducing electronic waste and standardizing on things that really matter and stuff like that. And so I think Apple's going to keep getting pressure from large markets. You know, if China did it, game over, right? Like, imagine if China said, okay, to sell a phone in China after you know, 2017, it has to have USB-C on the bottom. Lightning would be gone the next day. You know, so
they can make two different models, one for that market. They've made different models with different things inside them before. But like, China could do something like that. But my understanding of the EU thing is it's not like Apple can't sell it. I think it's more like a guideline or agreement. And I'm sure there's some kind of carrot and stick thing where if you follow along with the agreement voluntarily, you get some boon or whatever. But I'm not convinced that it's the type of thing where, like, if Apple doesn't do it, then they can't sell a phone in Europe. And if it was in China, where China can say, guess what, you have to do this no matter what, like, actually make it a requirement, I think they would make a different model. If the conversation had not been won inside Apple for USB entirely, because making a different model for China is probably fine.
I mean, and they have done that in the past for other things, but it seems like, you know, there's arguments on both sides of whether they should do this or not. And so if there's a big thing external, a big external factor that tips them one way or the other, they would probably go that way, right? And so if there's like a major world market of buying phones that demands in a pretty strong way or absolutely requires that they have a standard port on the bottom instead of their proprietary port, that would probably be enough to sway the argument one way or the other if there were no like massive downsides that we aren't thinking of. You know, like if there's some kind of major engineering challenge of doing it, but you know, on a brand new phone that they have designed separately from the iPhone 7 and 6, God, I hope, assuming we finally get a new design, then they could totally do it. And I don't see any obvious downsides, as we talked about last week. Anyway, I still don't think it's likely. I still think the most likely scenario is what Ming-Chi Kuo said, where, yeah, this rumor from the Wall Street Journal that was horribly written got the facts wrong, and it's actually just USB-C on the charger end. That's the way more likely explanation here. But I still do think it would be better to go USB-C on both ends, or at least the phone end. And there might be better reasons for them to do that. We don't know.
So the hardware mind virus worked on me because I was getting all excited about USB-C phones until I read this cold water story. I'm like, oh, never mind. But really what happened related to this is my Nintendo Switch did arrive, which maybe we'll talk about later. And I got a Pro Controller with it. And this is the first device, besides my Apple TV, which I never plug any USB-C things into, that I had occasion to see and mess with USB-C connectors with. Because when I got my Pro Controller, I had to plug it in to charge it, and there's a little USB-C connector inside the little Switch dock or whatever. And so I'm holding here the Pro Controller charging cable. And when I took this out of the box and plugged it in, my immediate thought was, oh, no way is Apple going to ever use this thing. It's huge! Like, I know it's not that much bigger than Lightning. It is barely bigger than Lightning. But just seeing it in real life, I'm like, can you imagine Apple putting this thing on their phone? No. No way in hell. Like, obviously, this is just my gut reaction. Like, I'm not using my brain at that point. But my visceral reaction to this connector was how massive it was compared to Lightning. And I was like, if I was inside Apple, I would, like, recoil in horror at the start of the conversation of, like, remind me again while we're doing Lightning again. It would take, look at this! Look at this! It's giant! We can't have this on our phones. It's ridiculous! What's next, VGA ports? So,
God.
It really isn't that much bigger.
I know, but I'm just like, it cracked me up that was my reaction. Like, it is not that much bigger. Like, I have a Lightning port here right next to it, and I'm holding it up next to it. Like, it is bare millimeters bigger. But the fact that it's wider and also thicker, it just makes it seem so much more massive. And it doesn't help that, like, I have one of the good old Lightning connectors here that in front of me with a very small plastic part that's barely bigger than the metal part. Like, it looks so small and dainty. It's almost like the Lightning can go inside a USB-C port.
Well, it almost can because of the gender flip that, between the connector and, yep, and the wire, you know, like and that's, and actually that's, I suspect, I don't know this for sure, I haven't looked that deeply into it, but I suspect the design of USB-C probably permits for there to be less clearance around the port opening. Like, I bet you can shrink the device thickness closer around the port size with USB-C than you could around Lightning, because Lightning has to have all the pins and everything on the inside, as opposed to USB-C, which has just, like, you know, the flat conductors on the inside. So I would imagine there might be something there with USB-C. Also, they have tons of room. They got rid of the headphone jack, and this other speaker on the bottom is fake. So they have tons of room on the phone.
I mean, thickness-wise, obviously, with they're not at a loss for. But anyway, it's not that big of a deal, and I still think it would be cool for them to go USB-C, but this rumor seems to say they're not, and so we're back to the default universe of Apple, where it's Lightning for a while longer yet.
What I do wish for, at least, since we're probably not going to get our USB-C on both ends cable, does anybody make the USB-C equivalent of these wonderful Anker, like, 5-port USB chargers? Like, all I've seen out there are chargers that have one USB-C port. I have not seen any that have, like, 5. Like, I would love to standardize on just one cable type, and just, like, it might, like, I'm traveling soon, and I'm packing my travel bag, and I have to have all these different cable types, because it's like, well, I need every combination of something on one end and something else on the other end, and I'll, like, everything between USB-A, USB-C, Lightning, micro USB, like, I have all these stupid cable types and these 50 different chargers. Come on, I mean, anyway, so I hope the USB-C ecosystem blooms soon. Because when it does, that will be even more reason for Apple to please, for the love of God, change the iPhone to use USB-C.
Speaking of VGA, you better hope USB-A, USB Type-A connector doesn't turn out to be the VGA port of our, you know,
hang
of
up
the most
forever.
Because you remember how long VGA held on? We had so many other standards that like, and it was just like you could not get rid of VGA. It just stayed stubbornly on the side of PC laptops, stayed stubbornly on projectors, long after multiple better, smaller standards existed. And I'm really hoping that USB-A hasn't, like, gained enough momentum that it will not be dislodged by USB-C for, like, an extra, you know, 5 to 10 years, just because. That will be sad.
You know, sometimes transitions are easier, like, the second time through. And in this case, like, the transition from dot connector to Lightning was very painful, but a lot of people took that opportunity to not just go to Lightning for their devices or needs, but to just go directly to wireless, to AirPlay and Bluetooth and things like that. With the VGA in conference room projector situation, I wonder, like, how many conference rooms actually just went from VGA to DVI or Lightning, and how many just switched to other solutions like AirPlaying to an Apple TV or something like that.
No. Spoken for someone who doesn't spend a lot of time in corporate America.
Yeah.
No, they don't use AirPlay.
Right. Well, but AirPlay is not the answer. But I got to tell you, so my office is all in on the Google ecosystem, which at first glance for an Apple-centric show like ours might sound terrible. But truth be told, it actually works out really well. And so in most conference rooms, there's a Chromebox. And I don't know enough about Chromeboxes to know if there's something special about them. Like, I've seen the physical cardboard boxes that the Chromebox comes in, and I think it says, like, Chromebox for meetings or something like that on it. The specific wordage doesn't matter. But what ends up happening is there's a TV in each of these conference rooms. There's a Chromebox hooked up to the TV, and the Chromebox shows, like, that room's schedule for the day, and you just select the currently active button, and that will jump into the Google Hangouts for that meeting. And not having used Google Hangouts prior to coming to the company, I had heard, like, a lot of mixed things about it, and I thought it would be kind of garbage, but it's actually pretty nice. And what we'll do is, if you are trying to present something to the meeting, you just hop on the Hangout on your laptop, and it will thus implicitly go to the TV in the conference room, and it will also be presented to anyone that happens to be remote as well. It works out surprisingly well. And yes, there's hiccups and coughs and whatnot from time to time, but it's really solid. I was very surprised how much I've really gotten to like Hangouts in this regard.
When your other choice is WebEx, anything looks good.
Yeah, that's true, too. Amen, brother.
Before we get on the topic of conference rooms, like, I remember going through this several years back at work when we were going through a corporate, disturbance, upsetness about conference room tech. Like, everyone was cranky about it, especially the tech people. And we tried all those things. We had a Google Box. We tried Google Hangouts. AirPlaying to Apple TVs came up, because if you look at how much money all the equipment we had that we were installing in his conference room was costing, it's like an Apple TV is nothing compared to that. And this is yet another market that Apple could have done well in with either a dedicated product like a Chromecast or just by making the Apple TV better. But it was basically a non-starter. Partially because, you know, no AirPlay on PCs and everything. But we had a lot of Macs, and I don't think that would have stopped it. Mainly because it was so much of a pain to get Apple TVs onto the corporate network. You could do it, but you needed a special weird utility, and it wasn't simple. And no one wanted to go through with that. So now, instead of being able to bring your Mac into the room and AirPlay to the projector, you plug into one of the 800 cables that's poking out of this giant Hydra. One of which, yes, is still VGA. Who knows what they're going to do if and when my work ever buys the new laptops that have the USB-C connectors, because most of the time the Mac users plug into HDMI these days.
Yeah, I have to imagine, too, like HDMI, because, you know, VGA was analog, and then we finally got DVI, and then HDMI, which is basically DVI with bonus stuff attached to it. I feel like it's easier to adapt to the new digital standards these days. And HDMI is also pretty well supported now. I mean, I don't think it's as big, like as universal as VGA was at its peak, but I think it's getting there. And it's going to be fairly trivial for almost any new port standard to adapt to HDMI for the foreseeable future, because it's just going to be in such high demand. Every new device that has video out capability will have some way to translate that to HDMI for a long time. So I think that it's mostly a moot point these days. We are sponsored this week by Pingdom, my favorite server monitoring service. Start monitoring your websites and servers today at pingdom.com/ATP. You get a 14-day free trial, and when you enter code ATP at checkout, you get 20% off your first invoice. Pingdom makes the web faster and more reliable for everyone by offering powerful, easy-to-use monitoring tools and services for anybody with a website. So Pingdom can monitor availability and performance of servers, databases, websites, anything with a URL from more than 70 global test servers. So you can see, for instance, like if there's some weird DNS problem where like your site is offline for only a certain part of the world, but it happens to not be where you live, you might not know about that otherwise, but Pingdom can tell you that. They can tell you so much, your performance, uptime. They can emulate visits to your site as often as every minute to check its uptime. And they can check for things like regular expressions or patterns or substrings or anything else, and all sorts of, you know, you can have it serve with cookies and conditions and everything. It's incredibly powerful. Stuff breaks on the internet all the time. And, I mean, heck, this past week, there was an interesting outage of Amazon S3. And that caused a lot of stuff to break. And Pingdom had a lot of outages to report. And, of course, they did. They did their job very well there, because they always do their job very well. I've been using Pingdom since, I think, 2007. It's been a very long time. I used it for the vast majority of Tumblr, all of Instapaper, all of Overcast so far. I use it for my personal site. Our friend underscore David Smith used to use it to monitor the Apple WWDC page for changes and have it alert him every time whenever the page changed, so we'd know when tickets went on sale, because you don't have to actually own the URLs that you're testing. There's all sorts of great uses for Pingdom. And of course, if you run a server or a website or any kind of web service, you need to know when your site goes down, and you need to be the first to know. You shouldn't need to wait around to later read Twitter and see, like, you've had 50 responses from people on Twitter that your site's been down over the last 3 hours, and you didn't even know about it. With Pingdom, you'll be the first to know. You can be alerted via text message, push notification, email, and you will be the first to know. So you can go fix it before all the people on Twitter see it and start bugging you about it, before your customers see it, before you lose any business. Check it out today. Go to pingdom.com/ATP for a 14-day free trial and get 20% off your first invoice with offer code ATP. Thanks to Pingdom for sponsoring our show.
Eric Peterman writes in, part of the USB-C spec is two-way power. Devices choose what charges what based on the order of plugging them in. So a Mac could charge the switch. So
that's
this
a terrible
is
way to do it.
It really is. This is with regard to the rumor, or maybe, I guess it wasn't a rumor, but somebody had plugged a switch into one of the new MacBook Pros, and they said, oh, this is weird. The switch is charging the MacBook Pro rather than what you would expect, which is the reverse. And this is what Eric's talking about. So I had heard separately from a not reliable source that was actually a firmware issue with the switch, but this indicates that it's all about who plugs into what when, which is kind of bananas.
The fact that it wouldn't be deterministic, like that it would, like, imagine like in real life, you know, anybody using these devices who isn't intricately familiar with the USB-C spec, you know, oh, I accidentally plugged this in backwards and depleted the device that I was trying to charge.
Plug your phone into your laptop and it drains your phone into your laptop.
Yeah. Like, why would you design a spec that way?
So weird.
Who knows? I haven't looked this up and see, but I think it's actually a reasonable way for things to work in the absence of anything else dictating. And I would imagine if you plug a phone into an Apple, you know, an iPhone into an Apple laptop, they already have a system through some resistor values, some other crap, to ensure that it never goes in the opposite direction. But if you have two devices that are basically, from their perspective, but I don't know, I'm making up terminology, but like two host devices, like the laptop and the Switch. Mm-hmm. That's as reasonable a way as any. If they both expect to be the thing charging, but they're plugged into each other, there has to be some kind of negotiation. So plug water sounds fine. But I would hope that for the common case where it's like one really big one and one really small one, like I would hope that the phone doesn't have the power to charge anything. I mean, I suppose it does. It powers like audio peripherals, but it's not charging them, right?
No,
I don't know.
Barely.
Yeah.
All right. Daniel Klein writes in, USB-C versus Lightning. Isn't the middle part of USB-C a lot more breakable than the solid Lightning connector? And he continues, more important than springs. I'm not entirely sure what he's referring to there.
Like, but the little springy bits. This is my concern about USB-C before seeing them. And even when you see it, you can kind of, you know, look into the female connector on USB-C, and you see the little circuit boardy thing with the contacts sticking out. And in theory, you could stick your fingernail in there and just crack that thing down and your port is dead. I don't have enough real world experience plugging and unplugging USB-C to say how fragile that thing is and how likely it is to either get stuff jammed around it or break. These are all question marks. I would imagine that it is probably sturdier than you think because it's wedged up in there, and unless you actually stick something in there to get at it, it's not someplace where it can get bumped or hit or anything. And when the connector is around it, it's very secure because it's completely surrounded by the thing. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, or give Apple the benefit of the doubt, or whoever designed this connector, that it is okay. And what this question made me think about, and some other people who asked similar questions about the springy bits in the contacts, and made me think about my what I was saying last show about how it is better to have the springy bits in the cable, because if they fatigue and start making bad contacts, you just throw out the cable and get a new cable, whereas the springy bits fatigue inside your iPhone, what can you do? There's not much you can do about it. But that was in the context of the hardware virus, where the springy bits get less springy and don't contact well with the contacts and start arcing and make a little burny spot, and that burny spot doesn't connect with another one and it spreads from thing to thing. Seems to me that could still happen no matter where the springy bits are, because if it starts arcing because the springy bits in your cable are bad, it's going to leave that little scorch mark on the stationary part inside the female USB-C connector. You won't see it. You won't see the little stripey thing, but it'll be there, which means that even after you throw out the cable, now one of your contacts inside your USB-C connector, inside the female end, is a little bit scorchy. And so when you stick your brand spanking new cable that you bought in there, it's going to have poor contact with the scorch part. So like that it could still happen is what I'm saying. Now, I guess this all depends on how resilient the springy bits are. Maybe it's the design of the springy bits that's different. They certainly, you know, look different if you look inside the connectors than they do inside Lightning. So I don't know. Again, it's very difficult to eyeball these things based on like the few people you know and your guesstimation by looking at connectors. Only the companies that make the products have actual numbers, and they don't seem to be sharing them. But I imagine if there is a large reliability difference between Lightning and USB-C, we as a society will learn that together over the next few years, because even though we won't have the data, eventually it'll be clear. Is there some sort of widespread problem with this and not a widespread problem with that? Or is there problems with both of them? You know, like, I imagine it'll be about a wash, but we'll see.
Jeff Spivak writes, more naked robotic MacBook Pros, and there's a link to Yanko Design, which has a super case for your MacBook. What the deuce is going on here?
It's just like the MacBook Pro. This isn't a MacBook Pro. This is a MacBook. But hey, you know, these laptops that Apple makes have USB-C and or Thunderbolt 3 ports on them, but don't have any other ports that people wanted. No SD card slot, no big honking USB-A slot or whatever. Maybe you want more battery on it. And these sort of cases for your laptops that plug into the USB-C and or Thunderbolt 3 port and add a bunch of other ports, just like one of those adapters or docks that they sell that are external, and maybe also adds battery. And so here you go, a naked robotic core of your MacBook. You want it to be thicker and a little bit heavier and have an SD card slot and a USB-A thing and another USB-C pass-through and a micro USB? I can't even tell what the hell this thing has on it. Anyway, you want a bunch more ports and you want it to look like an ugly PC laptop with a bunch of plastic crap? Get this.
Way to sell it, John.
It doesn't look good. But what I'm saying is, like, this is 100% the naked robotic core as applied to Macs. Like, we made it as small and as thin as possible. If you want something different, you can add it. like the tech is there, you know, like all the, like all those breakout docks and adapters, like the tech is there. You could put an Ethernet port in this thing, right? Go ahead. And it's kind of amazing that this, you add this thing to it and it makes your laptop like 7 times thicker, but it it really does. On one side have USB-A and an SD card slot. On the other side have another USB-A, USB-C and a micro USB or whatever the hell, or maybe it's just another USB-C. I can't tell. Like suddenly your MacBook One is MacBook way more than one.
Yeah, this thing is something else. I do commend the effort of things like this to make these laptops more useful, but I think they are destined to have the same problem, the same thing I always complain about with battery backpacks on phones, that all of the like casing and electronics of overhead of having to have like the separate standalone device with its own plastic on both sides and its own like metal shielding and different parts and charging components and discharging components and everything else, like the additional bulk of having to bolt this on as a, as an external thing makes the entire package end up being so bigger, so much bigger and heavier than if you had a laptop that just had these things in the first place built in, that it just doesn't seem compelling to me.
Yeah, and so the alternative in Apple's universe, assuming Apple doesn't actually make a machine that has the ports that you want on it, like, because Apple does make these things with a very capable port on it that is capable of supporting all this. Like, the reason these are going to exist is because there is a capable, the Apple alternative is a whole mess of adapters and wires. And we look at this and we say, oh, isn't it ugly? Is it inconvenient? It makes it thicker. It makes it heavier. Is it uglier and more inconvenient than a whole mess of adapters or an external breakout box dock? I mean, it really depends on the environment you're using it. I would be more happy carrying this from conference room to conference room, attending a series of meetings, no matter how ugly it is, because it's self-contained and I don't have to have, like, put down my laptop, then dump on the table a handful of adapters or a breakout box or this big hydra of cables. Like, that is worse in many ways for a machine that is supposed to be portable. So yes, it is technically possible to plug in a bunch of wires. It kind of reminds me of those old iMac ads where they would show like the PC with a million wires poking out of the back of it and show like the iMac and how clean it was and you didn't need all this stuff, just had one power cable, right?
That's,
and then the mouse and
that
keyboard.
Is like every MacBook One that people use to get anything beyond like the basics done on.
Yeah, and arguably they're using the wrong computer for that, but even I recall seeing, like, if you ever see a picture of a real person's, like, not just a marketing shot, but someone who bought a Mac Pro and uses it for work, bought a trash can and uses it for work, there's a million wires coming out of it, and it looks for all the world like those ugly PCs. I'm not saying this is the wrong solution, but it's kind of like how they always show, like, lamps in product shots without wires coming from them, or, like, appliances, or, like, there's never any wires. Like, wait, how does that lamp get power? They erase the wires because wires are ugly. They don't want you to see them. When they're showing a picture, like, you know, here is Samsung's fancy new TV, they don't show the wires coming out of it because that's ugly. You know, even when they show the back of it, they don't show the wires because they want to show you all the ports. Wires are ugly and inconvenient and make your products look worse and are generally annoying to wrangle. And so as ugly as this weird little sleeve thing is, I hope the signal it's sending to Apple is, hey, Apple, if you made a laptop that made a different set of compromises, you may be able to, you know, I feel like it should be Apple's job to make sure that no one ever wants to buy this thing. And maybe they don't want to buy it just because it's ugly, but say they had just an SD card slot, as we've discussed on the MacBook Pro 13-inch. Would that satisfy everybody? No, because it doesn't have micro, you know, USB and USB-A ports or whatever. But it would satisfy slightly more people, and what would the cost be? So it's very difficult knowing what the right compromise is for the complement of ports. I do like the idea that things like this are possible. I don't like the idea that people would be driven to buy them because they're not of Apple quality for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, this, like, you know, what you said, like, if Apple were to allow us to make a different set of compromises, if you had to boil down all of my complaints about Apple's hardware lineup from the last 5 years or so, that's it. Like, I wish Apple would allow me the choice of different compromises, because for the most part, they tend to enforce the same compromises on their entire product line, on every member of the family. So for instance, like, you know, all the laptops are now thin and lights, which sacrifice ports and now keyboard usability and trackpad usability. Like, they sacrifice these things in the name of thinness. And for a lot of people, that's great. It's great to have that as an option in the lineup, but I just wish it wasn't now the only option in the lineup. And I think products like this just show that there is still substantial demand, even though, you know, any given one of these types of things is not going to sell very well, I don't think. But I think it says something that this is not the first thing we've seen like this. And there's also the whole, you know, beyond just like the whole, like, you know, new bottom case thing like this that you kind of sit the laptop in, there's also the entire ecosystem of all these different USB-C hubs that, like, almost every MacBook One owner has one of these hubs, at least one, if not like seven from different Kickstarters and everything. Like, this really says, I think Apple, I wish Apple would look at these results and realize, like, it would be better for a lot of customers to just have different choices, not just to be able to pick your given screen size of the same compromised ultra-thin laptop. We are sponsored this week by Away. Go to awaytravel.com/ATP for $20 off your order. Use promo code ATP during checkout. Away makes basically like modern day, nicely, thoughtfully designed luggage at great value prices. So these Away suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, which is unrivaled in strength and impact resistance and very lightweight. The interior is incredibly thoughtfully designed. It features a patent-pending compression system, so you could fit a lot in there. They, of course, have four full spinning wheels for a smooth ride. If you never used four-wheeled suitcases, it's a pretty big upgrade over two-wheeled suitcases. They have, of course, a TSA-approved combination lock built into the top. They also have a couple interesting things, like a removable, washable laundry bag. So when you're out traveling, you put all your dirty clothes in this removable, washable laundry bag that's built into the suitcase, so you always have it with you, and it keeps it separate from your other clothes, and it's easy to take out later and wash. And they also, in their carry-on model, this is incredibly thoughtful. You might have heard about this elsewhere. In their carry-on model, they have a built-in USB charging battery. So you can plug in cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything else that's USB powered. You can plug it in and charge it with your carry-on suitcase from Away. A single charge of the Away carry-on's internal battery can charge your iPhone 5 times. And if anything ever breaks on these suitcases, Away will fix or replace it for you for life. They have a lifetime warranty. And of course, because you're buying a suitcase on the internet, which sounds kind of weird, they have you covered there too with a 100-day trial. So here's how this works. You can buy it for 100 days. You can live with it. You can even travel with it. So you can actually buy it, travel with it for 3 months, and then decide after that whether you want to keep it or not. If at any point you decide it's not for you, you can return it for a full refund with no questions asked. So check it out today. These are really thoughtfully designed, well-made suitcases with a lifetime warranty and a 100-day trial. So there's really nothing to lose here. Check it out at awaytravel.com/ATP and use code ATP during checkout to get $20 off your order. Once again, that's awaytravel.com/ATP and promo code ATP for $20 off your first order. Thank you very much to Away for sponsoring our show.
All right, so we're going to start tonight with...
We're starting tonight?
Well, sort of. With a couple, maybe all three of us, iPad grumps talking about Windows, or windowing, I guess I should say, on iOS. And Stephen Troughton-Smith, who is probably the best iOS hacker, and I don't know, I hate using that term unironically, but I don't know what else to call him.
I don't think he would take offense.
Yeah, I don't mean it in a disparaging way. Anyways, he has been putting together over the last week or so basically a windowing system for iOS, I guess specifically for iPad. And it is absolutely bananas how impressive it looks and how fluid he's gotten it to look. And there are several tweets about, well, there's many tweets about it. We'll put one or two in the show notes. But what's of interest to us, I guess, is he tweeted, phone call from app review, side-by-side windows, fine. Resizable windows, fine. Overlapping windows, scream emoji. So apparently app review does not like the idea of having two windows or views on top of each other. And this relates to one of my favorite iPad apps, not necessarily in terms of how much I've used it, but just I think it's an unbelievably clever idea, which is Panic's status board app, which, if you're not familiar, is basically you can arrange a series of widgets on the iPad screen and use your iPad as a status board. Or if you want to, you could plug it into a TV and use a whole TV as a status board powered by an iPad. And it's very similar to this. And so Cable Sasser of Panic says, still in our blog CMS is a never posted goodbye status board post. From the time Apple said widgets are okay, but we can't have more than one widget. And this post included an illustration that may have helped change their minds. And it's an illustration of this humongous TV with a little teeny tiny widget on it, trying to make the point of, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. So I don't know. There's kind of a lot to unpack here. But before anything else, I am so unbelievably stunned and impressed by what Stephen Trouton Smith has done with this iPad. I was going to call it a mock-up, but I mean, it's working. It's real.
It's a tech demo.
Yeah, that's a much better term for it. It's so freaking cool.
He basically made Finder.
Yeah.
Like a really simple version of Finder with like Finder windows and everything, and being able to browse files and preview them and everything. It's pretty impressive.
It's kind of like the Mac OS X Finder anyway. Not the real Finder, but you know.
Yeah, and it's and the point of it is not to be like a useful application. The point of it is, I think, to show off, like, here's a really easy, obvious way that you could do windowing on iPads, and let's see how it actually behaves and works. Like, is it useful? Is it easy to do? Is it confusing? Or does it just kind of work? And so far, I think it just kind of works.
You left off the last few tweets here, which I think are important in both Steve and Cable's thing. So Steve continues after his scared face emoji, or screaming face. I didn't know the correct... Sorry, Casey, I didn't know the correct name of that emoji, and Chrome couldn't handle it, so I couldn't actually paste it.
If only we had a resource on this show of somebody who was really an emoji expert.
Well, he handled it. He read right over scared face, and he replaced it with the correct, which I assume is the correct one, because we'll just defer to him.
He's fluent in emoji.
Right.
So I hear.
So this was about App Review saying the side-by-side window, you know, overlapping windows is no good, right? So he's saying, effectively, this is merely an informal heads up that if it were to be submitted to the App Store with overlapping windows, it would be rejected. Remember, he's not submitting an application to the App Store. He's just doing like tech demos on Twitter. And he gets a phone call from App Review saying, by the way, if you were to submit that, no. All right. And so the final bit here is, this is why the iPad can't have nice things. You're stuck waiting for Apple to innovate. Which is exactly the point of all this. It's like, who knows if this is a good idea? Maybe this is a terrible idea. But if Apple is going to not just enforce a set of guidelines in terms of quality and viruses and advertising and, you know, adult content and all sorts of other things that the App Store does, but to at this level to say, you know, you can do whatever you want if you're making a game, and UIKit will let you make a bunch of GUIs, but in the in-between place where you try to make your own GUI, we're going to say no to that. And it's like, Apple, you don't know. Like, it's a third-party application. Maybe it's a terrible idea and everyone will hate it. Maybe it's a great idea and you'll end up stealing it like Pull to Refresh. You have to allow application developers to do things like this with the devices that you're making. Like, this is not a ridiculous notion, right? And maybe if it was more ridiculous, it would be allowed. Because, again, games can, like, look, my whole screen is a big OpenGL view. I can do whatever the hell I want. And Apple's not going to be like, oh, your menu system in this racing game looks a little bit weird. Like, they don't care. It's fine. But this looks too much like a regular UI, and this is not, like, the image that Apple wants for their thing. And I feel like this starts to cross a line of, you're not ensuring quality in the App Store. You are constraining, you're constraining innovation, like legitimate innovation. He's not trolling with this. He's trying out an interface idea that is just as valid as half the other people's terrible uses of UIKit that end up being terrible interfaces. Maybe this will be terrible too. Who knows? But why is this not allowed? But so many other like sketching applications that have like drag off palettes that you can float. It's like, oh, that's okay because the background is your painting or your sketch that you're doing, and that's not a window. And then the things that are floating on top of it are windows, but they can't overlap with each other. It's ridiculous. Like, and so we are forced to wait for Apple to slowly, but you know, perhaps surely, perhaps not, decide what it's going to do with this whole window. Okay, picture in picture is fine, and Apple do that and make an official API for it. Can we have any other floating windows on top of other windows? Maybe one or two in apps I'll allow, but don't try to solve the whole problem in a general purpose way. Because only Apple's allowed to do that, so the users of the iPad, the users of iOS, are stuck waiting for Apple to figure out what to do. It is impossible for third parties to innovate on iOS devices because Apple simply won't let them. And that is terrible because most of the awesome innovations on the Mac and many of them on iOS came from third-party developers that did something. It became popular. Apple saw it and said, oh, that's a good idea. We should build that into the US or incorporate a similar mechanism or, you know, buy Super Clock and put a clock in the menu bar. I mean, come on. Come on, Apple. This is super disappointing, especially since they're proactively dickish about it, calling him and saying, you better not submit that to the App Store because we'll reject it, just so you know.
Well, hold on, though. Was that... I don't think that was out of the blue, and I might have this wrong, but my interpretation, which may be my own fabrication, was that he had submitted it for, like, test flight or something, and so as part of that, he got, like, a little mini review, and it was then that it was brought to Apple's attention, and then that they called him and were like, oh, no, that's not going to work.
But either way, like, but whether even if he had officially submitted it, the bottom line is that they are saying you are not allowed to innovate in this way, which I think is ridiculous. Let the app die on its own if it's a terrible idea, right? It's not, it's not malware.
Well, so there's been this rule, and I just checked, it's still there. There's been this rule, this app review rule, since I think the first publication of app review rules back whenever that was, like 2009, 2010. And it's rule number 258. Apps that create alternate desktop or home screen environments or simulate multi-app widget experiences will be rejected.
I know. Like Launch Center Pro had that problem a while back, too. I think that rule is bogus, too. Right?
Oh, I think so too. But I think it's worth questioning why that rule is there, and it might just be some, like, you know, crazy Steve Jobs control freak holdover. But there also might be good reasons for it. So it might be, for instance, like they don't want like another app to basically like start like its own entire app ecosystem within itself. Like, although it's, you can kind of argue that's kind of what like WhatsApp does and everything, but and Snapchat anyway. Facebook, geez. Anyway, but I think there's probably, like, this rule is probably not helping innovation overall. Like, this is probably holding things back. Now, that being said, you know, for any kind of, like, windowing system like this to get anywhere, the way to do it on iOS is for Apple to do it. Like, it's never going to get anywhere, you know, in the market like this.
Well, I disagree. If it was actually a good idea and it was implemented in a popular or soon to be popular, widely used creative application, like, for example, if Adobe Illustrator came and it had tear off palettes that you could overlap and rearrange just like the desktop one, right? That would be disallowed under the stupid overlapping rule things because you can overlap two palettes with each other. But if it was popular in that application and people liked it on their big iPad Pro, every competitor application would be scrambling to implement that. Any new competitor in the market would say, if I want to make a professional vector drawing application on the 12-inch iPad Pro, I need to have these floating overlapping palettes because the market leader has them and everybody loves them. And if I don't have them, you know what I mean? Like, let the idea live and die on its own. I agree that if you're going to say, okay, well, individual applications are going to be windowed, only Apple can do that, period. And that's fine. But just to see if bearing out the idea of, like, is it ridiculous to have people poking their fingers at window widgets? Is this a dumb idea? Does it not work in a touch interface? Like, the only way you will know is by trying. You can think about it. You can do the mental exercise and be like, oh, I don't want to drag around a window with a title bar. How would I arrange them? How does it work? You have to try. Like, I feel like this is the role of third-party developers. If someone wants to muck with that and see if it's useful, I think you can get a result that says either this is useful, and maybe it would be even more useful if applied broadly by Apple, but even just within the confines of an application, just like the floating palettes that are in a lot of applications now, where there's one floating thing that you can tear off and move around, that I think is proving its own utility, because you don't know where it has to be, and if it's always stuck to the side, it's kind of difficult. Let the person move it around so it's out of their way when they're drawing, but it lets them sort of configure their tool set and, you know, push it off to the side where they want it. Like, I think that is an idea that is showing its value merely when confined to third-party applications. And this is just taking to the next step. And maybe it's a step too far and it's a terrible idea. But Apple, you just got to let people try it.
Have you seen PanelKit, which is apparently an open source framework to do these kind of like snap to the side and like sticky popover panel sort of things? There's a really good animated GIF that's on the README for this thing. And we'll put a link in the show notes. But it's not exactly apples to apples what Steve Trouton Smith was doing, but it's very much of a similar spirit. And it looks really, like, I haven't looked at the code, but just the demonstration looks really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the more productive conversation to have on this kind of thing is not like how we can get Apple to let it through app review, because let's face it, they won't. Or if they suddenly have a change of heart on an ancient rule like this, it won't be because of us. But I think it's worth all these things, PanelKit and Steve Trouton Smith, you know, his thing, whatever. Does it even have an official name? I don't know.
I don't think so.
you know, I think it's worth talking about, and I think this is probably why he made it. It's worth talking about, like, does this work on iOS, and do you think there's a future of windowed apps in some form like this on iPads?
I don't know.
So yeah, on that topic, like, because I brought this up several shows back when, what was it we were talking about that had the floating thing? It was when we were originally talking about picture in picture, and there was some application that also had a floating thing on top of it.
Oh, I don't know. You got all the references.
It was a thing that we took. Come on, chat room. Marco will cut this out as we discover it. What was it? Floating iPad keyboard. See.
Oh, that thing. Okay, you're right.
Yeah, it was a floating keyboard
that I'm pretty sure Steve Trouton Smith also found.
Yes, a secret, a hidden API, a private API to put a keyboard that wasn't just the bottom of your screen that slid up from the bottom, but rather was a floating keyboard that was much smaller that you could move wherever you wanted on the screen. And that made me say, this is kind of like a window. And we have another example of that, which is picture in picture, but it's another kind of window, basically a little square that's on the screen that you can move wherever you want it, more or less within constraints, blah, 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 blah. Which is different than the traditional iOS experience, which is a panel comes in from a side or goes out from whatever, but you can't move it around, right? And that was me initiating the larger discussion about Windows with a lowercase w on iOS, spawned by this, you know, hidden keyboard type thing. And we also talked about some existing iOS applications, like drawing applications that also have floating palettes, usually only one of them, and it floats over the background, which is your drawing. But that is a thing that a lot of people are trying. And what I was trying to pitch them was that as if you want to keep taking the iPad even more and more pro, in addition to making the screen bigger, and especially when you do make the screen bigger, you want to make better use of that screen. And one proven way to let people make use of a larger screen is to give them different regions of it to do things, more than just splitting it up into halves or thirds or whatever, but even within an application to be able to move things around to arrange things the way they want them. Now, the thing I'm going to add to this conversation here is based on things that have been discussed on other podcasts starring Mike Hurley, but also on, well, yeah, Cortex, that's also him, and CGB Grey, talking about their multi-iPad type things, and for all the people out there who use multiple
iPads
at the same time.
Come on.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Or phones and iPads, which is just as common, where you got the iPad but your phone next to it or whatever. Very often this is presented as a way to, basically to multitask, like to say, my smaller iPad over here has this thing on it. My bigger iPad has this. My phone has this. So on my phone, I have messages available. On my little iPad, I have like Slack. And on my big iPad, I have the thing that I'm doing, right? CGP Grey often refers to it the same way that people have multiple pieces of paper around their desk at the same time. You have this pile of paper over here. And then the main thing you're working on, then you're referring to your notebook for notes. And you have a book open over here.
I think it's more like having multiple desks. It's like, I have this desk over here. And then my left-hand desk and my right-hand desk. Each hand has its own desk.
No, it is like papers. Again, if you were writing a paper referring to another thing and had a book open, right? For referring to your notes and had a reference book open, right? You would do that. Now, every time I hear them discuss this, and I'm not caught up on Cortex, so forgive me if this comes up sometime in 2015. But every time I hear this discussed in the distant past where I'm living in Cortex right now, I keep waiting for one of these two knuckleheads to realize that what they're talking about is called Windows. Why do you think we made Windows on personal computers? It was like a desktop, like a literal, like not a literal desktop, but the other meaning of literal, which is figurative, desktop, a metaphorical desktop, right? Like, it's the top of your desk. Like, it's not even a distant thing. Like, they were talking about the top. And then on that desk would be different documents, each of which would be represented by a window that you could move around. The only difference is that it was all within one piece of glass. So you would take the windows / documents and arrange them how you wanted, with the thing you're writing in the middle and the notes you're referring to on the left and an open reference book on the right. Only middle, left, and right would all be on the screen. And so it's maddening to hear people talk about, oh, I have my big iPad and my little iPad. Those are just windows, but they're physical now. And in some respects, it's better to have physical windows. Like, it is more, there are advantages to physical windows. But imagine if your whole desk was a freaking giant Retina screen and you could arrange these windows, we'll call them, and you'd have your little phone and your iPad. They're just differently sized windows, guys. You're just reinventing windows in meat space. They're just meat space windows. And, like, it's so painful to me to see, and I know they'll say, like, I don't want that. I don't want windows. Window arrangement sucks. Arranging my two iPads on my desk is great. And there is, I'm not going to say, there is something to that, because dealing with physical devices is better than dealing with Windows. There are compromises to having them all be virtual on a 2D device, but there are also advantages, really, really big advantages. And people with long experience with using very large screens with lots of windows on them, hello, that's me, can tell you that there are also advantages to that approach. And so I'm not saying one precludes the other and you have to stop the other one. I'm just saying they are siblings. They are solving the same problem in almost exactly the same way with only slightly different compromises. And if they're going to say that the multi-device thing is the way they prefer versus the other one, that's fine. But to never mention the other one and never realize that what they're essentially doing is exactly the same as having a really big screen with multiple windows, and that there are advantages to having a really big screen with multiple windows in that virtual things are easier to deal with and manipulate than real things. Like, you can't switch spaces. You can't swipe your four fingers to the left and suddenly a new desk slides in with a new set of iOS devices on it, like Casey does with his spaces, right? You can't minimize or window shade or snap them to edges or resize them because you can't make your iPad mini into a different orientation or a different size. Like, there are trade-offs to be sure, and I'm not saying one is dominant over the other, but as a strong, strong proponent of the virtual pieces of paper as, you know, as a better approach for me personally than the physical pieces of paper, or the virtual screens, aka Windows, instead of the physical screens, aka iOS devices, I think this has to be in the mix. And that's why when I see Steve Trout and Smith's, like, let's make some Windows on iOS devices, I say yes, yes, finally. Because if Apple ever does make a 27-inch iPad, an approach that I think would appeal to a lot of people is to be able to have different overlapping resizable things so that you're not, you know, because who wants to split a 27-inch screen into thirds or halves or quarters? Or, like, I know everyone loves tiling window managers on Linux or whatever, but there's a reason they have not taken the world by storm, right? Not that overlapping windows is the greatest either. They have anti-patterns too, and people do like to zoom everything to full screen, but I feel like this is an avenue that has to be pursued. It may not be the ultimate answer, and it may be some hybrid of panels and snapping actually is the best compromise for most people, but you have to pursue it because it has proven utility. We all sit in front of Macs all day, and somehow we manage to get work done in this chaos of overlapping windows where we can never tell what the hell's going on, and we're the janitor. Like, somehow we do it, right? So I desperately want to see this avenue pursued in every way by third-party application developers, by Apple experimenting, and yes, by Apple doing things in the OS and releasing larger iOS devices. And for all you multi-iOS device users,
oh, you're butchering
it. I kind of say more power to you, because you are kind of like the steampunk of multiple windows, because they're steampunk windows, basically. They're steam-powered. They're physical manifestations of windows. And they're ugly and dirty and grimy, and they're made of brass, but you like them, so go for it. Add some beard oil.
Wow.
John, I love you.
That was incredible.
Oh, my word. I feel like this episode's done. We're done. Good night, everybody. That's it.
I mean,
it's over.
Do you guys get what I was saying with the multiple windows? Like, I don't know where you guys fall on multi-devices versus multiple windows, and I know you're not as gung-ho on multiple windows as I am.
Multiple
but, like,
devices is a terrible solution to this problem. It is... You know, in some contexts, if you're trying to do certain things as an iOS power user, sometimes it's the only solution to the problem. But, you know, I think, and granted, you know, to be fair to the multi-pad lifestyle people, I don't think this is the only reason they do that. It's not just to have two different applications running at the same time. There's other reasons why they would have multiple devices. For, you know, the same reason that many of us have multiple Macs, like, you know, to have, like, a big one and a small one for travel versus home, you know, stuff like that. So, all those things aside, and honestly, I think running two apps side by side on two different iPads is probably a fairly uncommon use of multiple devices that from the people who have them. But if you can picture a future version of iPad multitasking where you could just resize the apps, not just with the split view that we have now, where you can have at most two apps on screen, if you don't count picture-in-picture video playback as one of them. So you have at most two apps on screen, and they can only be arranged left and right in just different split sizes that are like three different preset sizes that they can possibly be. That's very limited. It's a lot better than having no multi-window environment on the iPad like we had before iOS. What was it, 9 that added that? It's a lot better than that, but it's not nearly as powerful as having a more free-form system like overlapping windows or just more than, you know, even if it has to only be tiling windows and so they can't ever overlap. Even if that's the case, iPad screens are a lot bigger than phones, and any universal app is made to scale from an iPhone 5S all the way up to an iPad 12.9. Why can't you have like six windows on screen? Like have it be like a 3x2 grid on the 12.9 inch. Each one would be about the size of a moderately sized iPhone. Why couldn't you do something like that? Like have six apps open at once, or have four apps open at once where they're all small rectangles, or something like that. Like I feel like there's so many more places iPad multitasking can go. And granted, there's a few fundamentals that really need to be built first before that makes a lot of sense. Things like drag and drop and some kind of more coherent file system access in some form. But ultimately, multiple applications being open at once and not just two of them is the direction this has to go for these devices to become more productivity powerhouses.
Yeah, and I think, you know, John, I think that Mike and CGP Grey would both say that this is a terrible solution. Like I think one of you said that a minute ago, but it's important since they're not here to defend themselves to stress that I don't think that they love the solution. It's just that they do love iOS and they're hamstrung by the things that iOS lets you do. And I feel similarly. I mean, I do love my iPad, but I've been really, really strongly kicking around the idea of getting a MacBook Adorable, expressly because I want something that's effectively as portable as an iPad or as close as I can get to that, but that doesn't make me feel hamstrung every time I use it. And to me, the best answer to that question is a MacBook Adorable. For them, I don't think they feel near as hamstrung in general. The problem is simply that they can only do but so many things at once. And so for them, it does make sense to live the multi-pad lifestyle. I think it's a little bit kooky, but just because I think that doesn't mean that it wouldn't work for them. And clearly it does.
The most common multi-device thing I would imagine is a personal computer style device and your phone. Because like I said, there are definite advantages to steampunk Windows. And one of them is you compartmentalize the thing. So very often it's text messaging, whatever your text messaging service is of choice. Text messaging on your phone while doing other things on your computer. And your computer may have messages on it, or maybe it doesn't have whatever app you're using, or maybe you don't choose not to get messages. But that division of labor, you're sitting somewhere, you know, sitting in a coffee shop, typing something on your computer, and you get a text message, and you look at it on your phone. That steampunk window, it's physically in a different location. You're in a portable scenario where you can't have a gigantic 30-inch drafting board, you know, Surface Book Pro. Like, you can't have that. You're on the go. It is a different sight line, a different focal distance. It is a physical device that you're used to texting people from. All your past texts and the apps that you love are on there. Using that as a steampunk window to do your texting is perfectly valid and probably is an advantage over trying to cram your messages window onto your 12-inch MacBook screen next to the thing that you were trying to write in your distraction free writing environment, right? So, like, I get it. I get why there are, because I do it myself sometimes when I'm at work. Sometimes at work, I will send and receive text messages on my phone, even though I could be getting them on my Mac screen, just because it is a nice compartmentalization of work versus personal, you know, texting over who's going to pick up what kid from what activity or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it makes sense to me to do that. Starts to make less sense when you're in an environment where you have a big desk and arrayed on your desk, you have a series of iOS devices of different sizes, because then I feel like you're compromising in ways. And, you know, who is this? Casey's saying, like, they're using iOS because they want to. And I understand that. And they have to do this because they're limited in their multitasking, and they more than anyone would like richer multitasking. So I'm not slamming them for saying you should just use Windows, because you can't. You can't use it on iOS. And if you want to use iOS devices, we're stuck waiting for Apple to innovate there. It's just frustrating to me that we seem to be creeping. Users are organically creeping up on that solution, and that the solution is much bigger iOS devices suitable for a desktop environment that supports something like Windows that gives the users more flexibility in how they arrange their space. Everybody does it. This is one of my big things with the whole Spatial Founder rant. Everybody arranges their workspace, especially if it's a job you're doing all the time, whether it is a carpenter arranging their tools or an artist arranging their palettes and their paints and their brushes and their easel, like, and having or a chef setting aside all the ingredients that they're going to, you know, use in their thing. Like, everybody arranges their workspace. Efficient workers do arrange their workspace. We all do it on our computers now. We all have different arrangements and different amounts of things. And whether you use Spaces or not, or Tiling Window Manager or not, or maximize everything and flip through them with your fingers, or alt-tab through things, or click, like, That's the thing that we're going to do no matter what. We do it with Windows. We do it with our steampunk Windows. We do it in the physical world. And I think no matter what our interface to work is, it has to allow us to do that in some way. And so, you know, Mike and CGP Grey and everyone else who's living the multipad lifestyle, they're doing it the only way that is available to them with the tools that they like. But I think we have to acknowledge that the other approach is fairly well proven at this point for a certain set of users. It is disproven for a certain set of users as well, because we all know that novice users, the reason why they love iOS is because it doesn't let them have to deal with this crap. They don't get all confused by a bunch of windows, right? But for a certain set of users, you know, if you were to tell someone that they had to, you know, do 3D animation for Pixar, but they weren't allowed to use Windows, they just had to use everything full screen or a split screen, they would have a much harder time getting their job done, I would imagine.
Also, I mean, like, one other, like, side benefit, like, if Apple were to do windowing on iPads, it would also solve a tremendous problem of the iPad app ecosystem, where iOS apps are often not very well optimized for the iPad or aren't optimized for it at all. And sometimes they're really big apps like Instagram, which famously, like, still does not have an iPad app, and also shut down the API that allowed other iPad apps to exist for them. Imagine if, instead of having the, you know, the dumb, like, you know, giant letterboxed iPhone simulator version on iPad, what if you launched a non-iPad optimized app and it just launched in an iPhone sized window, and you could drag it around and you could have other apps that you could shrink down to that size and tile around your screen if you wanted to? Like, almost every iPad app that is a universal app with its phone version can, again, it can scale to all these different sizes. You could solve problems like this very, very well. Also, things like, you know, when Apple does make larger iPads, like, there's still a lot of iPad apps that aren't optimized for the 12.9. What if, when you launch one of these things on a 12.9, it just launched in a 9.7 sized window, and it was just one of many windows on your screen? Like, there are lots of benefits to this. And granted, there's a lot of UI challenges and a lot of probably technical challenges of things like, how do you manage memory for all these different apps that could be, you know, appearing to be running all at once and be in the foreground all at once. And lots of API challenges with things like touch handling and what kind of gets the attention and what doesn't. And there's some weirdness already with, like, multitasking of, like, if you have a keyboard connected and you have, you know, two different apps open right now during multitasking, and you hit a shortcut key on the keyboard, which app gets it? And right now, I think it's just, like, whatever app you tapped last or something. But it's like, but there's no active state on the title bar to indicate which one that is. So you just have to know or guess or try it. So, like, if they were to go in a direction like this that brought, like, full blown windowing in some form or full blown multitasking like this to iOS, there is a lot of work to be done. It's not a small task. This is not something they could do in, you know, likely one release. You know, this is like a massive undertaking, and they've already done some of it, but doing a more freeform system like what we're describing would require a lot more of it. But I think the result would be pretty great and incredibly powerful, and would really revive the iPad for productivity use, which it does seem like Apple needs something to do that. That would be great. And that would also, you know, if we do it the way I was saying, where, like, you know, non-optimized apps would just launch in old device-sized windows, that could also solve this major market and software ecosystem problem that the iPad also faces. So, like, this would be a really great solution in a number of ways. The only question is, like, would they ever do it? Would it be worth devoting the resources to? And would they then just be recreating the Mac poorly? You know, like the old Lisp joke, like, or Unix or whatever, probably applies to everything.
Well, they should be recreating the Mac better. They should be learning from the Mac and you know, making it better, faster, like, you know, the $6 million man type of thing. They should, like, trying to slowly convert the Mac into a thing that is better than Mac is difficult, but iOS, you know, is a relatively clean slate. They can reconsider everything. They can only bring over the things that are good. They can make different compromises. They can skew it in a particular direction. They can try to make it so users who can't deal with lots of windows don't have to, like, shave off the sharp corners, because everyone's seen someone struggle to manage windows on a personal computer, but, you know, the lowercase w, again, whether it's on the Mac or on the PC, even in on the PC where everything is full screen and people are alt tabbing, there's still some confusion about floating things and layering and dialogue boxes that appear and where did it go and mission, mission control and formerly expose and all that was supposed to help with that. And all those are great things. Those are all things to learn from. Finding the right compromise for iOS devices where most of the time it works the way most people want it to, but that the more advanced users have the ability to get the productivity advantages that these people are currently getting with multiple physical devices. That's the balance that Apple should strike. And I think it's great to do that on iOS where you are not constrained by even making something like Steven's thing here where it looks like a Mac window. Who says the title bars are the right thing? Who says that the window should have window widgets? What about scroll bars? Like, you can rethink everything. But
yeah,
I'm thinking broadly speaking, like you were saying, applications running simultaneously as we get more and more RAM becomes much more viable, and figuring out what that means as screens get bigger, letting people divide up the screen space the way they want to divide it up among the applications that they want to run. And then eventually gets in, you can decide, is space is the right approach to this thing? What about preserving the arrangement? Because sometimes you do side-by-side windows, but then you go off and do something else. How do you get back into that side-by-side arrangement? Or maybe you want to go back to just one application and not be in a side-by-side arrangement. There are so many things that are still undetermined, and it's young and they haven't made a lot of decisions yet. So I think it's fine. But, as Marco pointed out, they already painted themselves into weird corners where like, oh, we allowed multiple things on the screen and we allowed keyboard shortcuts, but we never thought of a way to indicate which one has the focus. So already we're in a weird situation. Like, they should think more of those through before they take the next step. Maybe they are. Maybe they're like, we don't want you to do this because we have this awesome idea that's going to be out in 5 years and we don't want you stomping on it. But I think it's silly. I think you should let third party developers go nuts and figure out what works, and maybe you get some good ideas from them.
We are sponsored this week by Squarespace. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. Almost everything we do today uses a website. You need a website for any kind of online store or blog or portfolio or business or new project or podcast. Almost everything that you would do needs a website these days. But it's not really worth installing a whole CMS and building the entire thing from the ground up and having to manage a server and having to manage software updates and everything else and then having to hire somebody to custom design it for you. That's so much overhead and hassle and cost and time, when really you should just have the website be taken care of as quickly and easily as possible and then move on to your actual project that you're actually building the website for. Squarespace lets you do that. Whether you're making a site for yourself or for somebody else who's asked you to make a site, because if you listen to the show, you probably know how to make websites, and you've probably had people in your life ask you to make them for them. Squarespace is so much better than any other option out there for making most websites, because they have built-in templates, they have built-in widgets and capabilities. So much is built in that you can do a remarkable amount in less than an hour. Like, I challenge you, next time you have to make a website for anybody, for yourself or somebody else, try it on Squarespace first. Give me the benefit of the doubt here. Try it there first and just see how far you get in an hour or less even. And I bet you're going to get so far that you're going to decide, you know what? This is done. Like this, or you can finish it like in another hour and then you're done. That's it. No matter what your skill level, whether you're a novice or whether you're a web programmer, you can get so much done with Squarespace. You can make a beautiful website. It looks professionally designed and it stays up because they manage it for you. They support it. If you're making it for somebody else, it's very important. They support it. You don't have to worry about all the back-end stuff. They take care of it, and your site looks awesome. Check it out today. Start a free trial with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with Squarespace.
Speaking of iPad woes, Apple... God, we're going to get so much anger from the iPad people. I'm so sorry, everyone.
We shouldn't. We all said good things about the iPad.
Yeah, and the good thing is, like, the Cortex hosts have now moved on from talking about the multi-pad lifestyle. Now they're both just slowly becoming programmers, but they're both in denial of that fact.
Yep.
They both just kind of keep inching more and more towards, like, guys, you're actually just becoming programmers, and it's okay, and that's good. There, it turns out there's a way to automate our computing tasks.
You just write these little things. You could call them, programs.
Yeah, it reminds me of some, what did I see? Somewhere in some business snark website thing talking about specifications for software projects, like if you write up the requirements right? And you'd write up the requirements, and you typically the requirements like, I want to do blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's too vague. I don't know exactly what you want. So you go back and forth about the requirements. How do you want it to work? No, how do you really want it to work? Do you want it to work like this, work like that? And eventually the business person getting frustrated, and it's like, look, just I'm going to tell you exactly how I want it to work with no ambiguity. And it's like, if you do that, what you've done is write a program.
Yeah.
to specify it, that's what programmers do. Like, people just want to specify it and the yada yada, you sort out the details. In the computer, you can't yada yada. You have to say, no, how exactly do you want it to work? All right, I'm going to tell you exactly how you want it to work. In every condition, here's what you should do, blah, 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 blah. It's like, that's program. That's called programming. You want to be a programmer now. So go ahead, right?
You can
very quickly find yourself becoming a programmer with an accidental programming podcast, becoming a programmer without knowing it, because eventually you'd be like getting down to a level of detail where you're telling it, I'm going to tell you about every possible eventuality, what you should do. That's programming. Like, yeah. Computer doesn't know, it just does what you tell it.
Well, and I love how, like, I think Mike in particular is in a special denial place here of, like, he makes fun of, well, not making fun of, but, like, he talks about the way developers use the terminal and just geeks use the terminal as this kind of, like, crazy opaque thing that is this, you know, incredibly, you know, geeky, obscure. And then like, they're talking about you, like, using workflow against web APIs to automate certain things. Like, it's the same thing. Like, it's a different era of the exact same thing. Like, the same kind of learning curve, really. The same kind of, you know, similar kind of capabilities. As usual, the old people like us think the old way was better, but, you know, it's really the same kinds of things.
Yeah, although I think Mike, my understanding of what Mike is doing is that he's largely cribbing what others like Federico or CGP Grey have done and modifying them a little bit. But to build on what you were saying, so on the surface, you know, it sounds like, oh, Mike's not really a programmer at all. But really, that's how all programmers work, is they take something that gets you 80% of the way there and fix what you need in order to get the rest of the way. And so I agree with you. And Federico, to me, is the king of this, because
He's
writing, like, ridiculous Python scripts and these, like, hyper-involved workflows with, like, potentially even recursion within them. And it's just, he is a developer. We actually, Federico and I, in a happy way, had this fight, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, where I said to him, dude, you are a developer at this point. Like, don't even try to pretend you're not. And he didn't want to hear it. Not in a jerky way. He just was like, no, I'm not a developer. I don't know how to do the stuff you guys do. I'm like, you're doing it. It's not even a question. It's already happening.
Yeah, like, in the same way, like, that our friend Dr. Drang is, you know, like, Dr. Drang posts on leancrew.com, and, like, he's not a programmer by trade, but he writes tons of scripts, most of which are in Python, to do all sorts of things for his work. And so, like, while he probably does not consider himself a programmer, he uses programming, he knows a programming language, and he uses it to get tasks done for his work. And there's lots of room for that type of person. You know, just like, look, I mean, like, Microsoft Office has forever had its macro language, right? That's the same thing. That's just Visual Basic. Like, it's the same. That's also programming. My first job was programming VBA in a giant Excel spreadsheet for some company to save them a bunch of time. Like, that's a lot of what programming in the real world actually is. It's like people doing, like, little custom or one-off things. That is programming. There's kind of this continuum of, like, power users. Like, the first thing you learn as, like, a power user is you might learn, like, a keyboard shortcut for some common stuff. And you're like, oh, my God, this is great. And then eventually you might learn some kind of automation of something. Like, you know, first you kind of figure out, like, how do you do manual work faster, right? That's, like, the keyboard shortcut approach. Then you start figuring out, like, how do I actually, like, use the computer's immense speed and power to do things faster than I could do them manually? And that's when you start getting into, like, the basic things like batch operations in pro apps. On the Mac, you'd have things like Automator. And on the iPad, you have things like Workflow. And then eventually, I feel like the next step after that is, like, no, you're actually just writing code of some sort, whether it's just a simple thing like a shell script or a JavaScript thing, or whether it's actually, like, you know, a Ruby or Python, like what we'd call, like, a real language script or app to do something custom. Like, these are all just points on the power user curve. And being a programmer is not, like, some special boundary that you have to, like, go to college to know how to do. No, it's just like, it's just the next step on that curve after you've used tools like Workflow or Automator, and you kind of want a little bit more customization or a little bit more power. And then you get into these things that really are programming. You just might not realize it until after you've been doing it for a while.
Yeah, Mike and Vitici would both be making HyperCard stacks 30 years ago. I don't know, you guys don't remember that era, but
I used HyperCard.
Yep, same here.
There used to be many more. Yeah, back before Apple and most of the rest of the industry gave up on the idea of trying to make programming easy enough for people who didn't want to be into programming, there were many, many attempts, AppleScript is one of them, to try to make programming more accessible to the masses with something that is farther along that curve, that actually is a real programming language, but is a language that looks friendlier or whatever. And lots of people made HyperCard stacks. And like, it's another accidental programmer thing where, sure, people made HyperCard stacks, and most people, it wasn't easy enough for them to tackle. But many people who didn't consider themselves programmers were, like, they weren't intimidated by HyperCard and like, oh, I'll go through these tutorials. Oh, I can make a button. Ooh, I click a button and it makes a beeping noise. Like, and, you know, and for someone, trying to make a button on a Mac of that era was much harder if you were using the Mac toolbox than it was in HyperCard. And so they could be successful pretty quickly. And for the people who had, who were into that, who were like, they never thought of themselves as programmers, but it turns out if you introduce them to it, fast forward 3 months, and they're writing this incredibly complicated HyperCard stack using HyperTalk like a real programmer, and they have suddenly found themselves, it's not everybody who does, it's not like it turns people into programmers. It reveals programmers that were always there, right? And they just, you know what happens with someone who is like just naturally wants to do this? They start off with the beeping button, and you just step away for like a couple of weeks and you come back and it's like, what have you done? And like, they have made this entire world for themselves, and well, they have no formal education. They don't know what a subroutine is. They don't know any theory about data structures, but they're like deriving from first principles the basics of programming in HyperTalk, and, you know, doing incredible, I saw it all the time, doing incredible things. And it's like someone who runs a general store and makes a HyperCard stack to do their inventory. And it's like, you may not know it, but you are now a programmer. And this is the thing you could have done as a profession, even though you have no formal education in it and really still don't quite know what you're doing in the formal sense. But you are rediscovering the rudiments of programming with no instruction from anyone else, merely by having a box in front of you and knowing some basic things. And that is a beautiful thing to see. And I love hearing stories of like places that are still running HyperCard stacks and like their Mac SEs just because like they run their entire business on it and somebody wrote it years ago. I guess it's more heartwarming because I know it. It's not quite as heartwarming for people who are still running their payroll on COBOL or whatever, but I think Y2K took care of a lot of those. But either way, like that, for people who are listening who think they will never be programmers, that's possible. You may never be it, but there's a reason people call it like the programming bug. Like, you get bitten by it and you just find, that happens to all of us here on this podcast, I'm sure, and everyone else who's into computers. At some point, you get exposed to something and it just, you know, it sinks its teeth into you and you lose track of time, you lose track of the years, and you realize this is just this whole world that you bury yourself into. Some people are exposed to the exact same thing and are like, meh, not for me, right? But the distinction between those people has nothing to do with education or even desire. It is just like how their brains work. Is programming addicting to you? You will know that pretty quickly. And you look at someone like Vitici, guess what? Programming is addicted to him. Like, he would not be doing these things he's bitten so hard by this. Like, he's mad with the power of being able to tell the computer to do what he wants it to do in a series of sophisticated ways, breaking down the problem into smaller pieces and recombining them, right? He's bitten by it so hard. Just because he's not writing C doesn't mean that he has not, A, bitten by the programmer bug, and B, become a programmer.
Well, and I feel like that's the whole beauty of computers, is like when you break that barrier between, like when I was saying on my curve about like when you're just doing manual things faster versus when you have the computer start working for you and way faster than you ever could manually. The whole beauty of computers is the ability to cross that line, the ability to do that. Like when, like the famous Steve Jobs quote about the computer is a bicycle for the mind. Like, it's not because you know all the shortcut keys to do things repetitively over and over again. It's because you can just like put in some, just the right kind of input, and this computer can just skyrocket past you executing that code way, way, way faster and more reliable and more consistently than you ever could, or doing things that you could never do in a practical amount of time. Like, and it's just like, one of the reasons why I get frustrated when things like, you know, iOS move or start in directions where things are really locked down and it's hard to do that kind of stuff is because I feel like that's kind of missing or kind of like blowing the whole advantage that computers have given us as a society. Like, the whole point of computers is to enable humans to do things, to have these kind of, you know, information-based tasks done in ways and at speeds and in volumes that we could never do on our own, like through manual calculations or anything else. And for any computer platform to be truly empowering to its users, it has to allow that in some way, and hopefully in a reasonably easy and capable way. And efforts to do that on iOS are really, really held back by just the limitations of iOS. And things like Workflow and Pythonista, like, these things have existed and do exist and are good for people, but there's so much further to go to make them even just match the level of power and sophistication that regular people can achieve on, you know, Windows or a Mac, let alone like on, you know, future things that we might think of even better ways to do these things. And so that's kind of like, it kind of hurts me philosophically whenever it appears the computing platform is going in the opposite direction.
And what most of these people are doing, by the way, like in the continuum, is that you can use tools made by other people, which is what the App Store is great. Like, it gives regular people access to tools that other people have made for doing common tasks. Hey, so you're taking the inventory of all the books that are on your shelves. There's an app that you can just point your phone at it and it will look up, you know, so on and so forth. Like, it's a tool to do a job better, right? The next step along that is, I don't see any tool that does the thing that I want it to do. I'm going to make my own tool. So it's not just that they're automating repetitive tasks, but that they are building a tool for them to do whatever real-world tasks they're doing, whether it's managing their business or doing their hobby, keeping track of their model trains or controlling their model trains or whatever. Like, they don't see the thing that they want in the world, and they realize they can make this thing do what they want it to do. So they build a tool for themselves. And it doesn't mean they have to suddenly become an app developer and sell that thing or whatever. It's just like the people who use a FileMaker database to manage their, you know, retail store or something where they sell cameras. They don't consider that they're making a tool to accomplish some other task. That's just another point in the line. Using other people's tools versus saying no one else makes this tool, or the tools they make aren't to my liking and I can make my own tool to do it. Vitici is essentially making his own tools for his workflow because there's no existing thing that integrates all the different pieces the way he wants them to do, and he has specific needs about it. So, you know, it's not just, you know, in some cases he is automating something you would have to do manually, but in other cases, like, it's not application development, but it's tool building. And we all do that. We're smart little monkeys that use a stick to, you know, hit something instead of our hands because the stick is better, right? You know, it's all, you know, a bicycle for the mind has more poetry than a wooden stick for
a monkey with a stick.
Yeah, or the monkey with the bone from 2001. But that's basically what it boils down to. And taking away the ability to, or, you know, not taking it away, but making the barrier to making your old tools mean, like, either you get to use tools other people made, giant gap, Xcode. That gap is too big. It's too big for most people to cross. And there, apps like Workflow show that there is, or even Automator or simple scripting languages or anything like that, or HyperCard, all that stuff. Even though most of the experiments failed in what they thought the goal would be, like, everyone's going to be a programmer. Nope, that's not going to happen, right? But you do need something on that middle tier for the people who are never going to graduate all the way up to being a full-fledged programmer and using Xcode. But they don't need to. They just need something in the middle that can, you know, they can let them make the tools to make their life better, even though their goal in life is not to be an application developer and they never need to make something in Xcode and submit it to the App Store.
So, Apple and education. Bringing this back around.
Slight sidetrack.
Yeah, for after that 45-minute sidetrack.
Wait, was that the topic?
Believe it or not. Because then we got into saying how people with iPads are going to be mad at us, and we just get buried back in iPads again.
That's right. They're all secret programmers. All
right. Right. So anyway, so Apple and education, there's a New York Times article that says, the headline is Apple's devices lose luster in American classrooms. And I didn't get a chance to read the article, but my understanding is basically that there are fewer devices being shipped to schools from Apple. It seems like Microsoft is slightly on the up, and Google, thanks to Chromebooks, is way on the up. Which is great, I guess, for Google and kind of a bummer for Apple since this used to be their stronghold. I mean, I think I can speak for Marco in saying my only exposure to a Mac or to an Apple II was at school. Like, I didn't have any friends that had one. It was always at school that I was exposed to it, and that seems to be changing now. It seems to be all Chromebooks, but well, I don't know.
My experience was slightly different in that my first exposure to Apple computers was indeed at school, but it was to the Apple II. In the early 90s.
The heyday of the Apple II.
Yeah, my school was so poor that the only computers they had were like ancient hand-me-down Apple IIs, most of which were not even like, you know, the later models. They were like, you know, the old, like, you know, green and black one, like, you know, before color and things like memory. It was pretty basic, but I loved them because they were the only computers I'd ever used up until that point, and they were amazing, even in like 1992, whenever that was. And then after that, like when a few years later, I went to a different school and they had just PCs, because at that point that was like 93-ish and 94, and by that point, like, you know, Macs I think were too expensive for most schools at that point. And I think, like most schools, there was one Mac in one of the computer labs that you weren't allowed to use unless you were in some kind of like graphic design class that like they could use it. But otherwise, it was all PCs for the same reason that we're probably about to talk about, which is cost. Because when you're in schools, cost is a really, really big factor.
So, this article, the news in this article and the graphs in this article, it's not a surprise to Apple. Apple knows all these things. Apple knows how much it's selling. Apple knows how much its competitors selling. And the graph they show is only from 2012 to 2016, so it's not a long span. But they show it basically because Google comes out of nowhere, basically like zero market share sometime in 2010 or 11, and flies past both Apple and Microsoft, who are more or less flat, flies past them around 2014, and now is at like four times their sales volume in terms of units, right? So that's in a very short period of time, Google comes out of nowhere and becomes the dominant player in the market. And the fact that Apple knows that this happened, because they keep track of their own stuff, but seemingly has not had a strong response to it. I know we talk about the pro market mostly on this program, but imagine we were, instead we were very interested in the education market. We would be complaining that Apple has faced a strong competitor in the form of Google for many years now, and its reaction to it has been half-hearted features to let more than one person use an iPad at the same time by logging in and out and storing crap on iCloud, and some improved management stuff, and a bunch of new different shapes and sizes of iPads, which all seem like they're good and fine, kind of like their efforts to add like multitasking stuff to the iPad in a different realm. But if you look at the, you know, has this made them competitive again in the education market, or is Google still kicking their butt? Answer, Google's still kicking their butt if you measure things in terms of unit sales. Maybe Apple doesn't measure that. Maybe I don't care what the hell the unit sales are. We're making all the money. We make all the profit. That is, I guess, a reasonable place to be in. But when it comes to education, I have to think that you shouldn't really view it as a profit center. Not that you shouldn't make money on it, but like one of the most important things Apple is getting out of it is just what Marco talked about and Casey talked about, and me too. Like, we saw Apple computers in school, and it doesn't mean that we're going to grow up to only use Apple computers, but it sure as hell doesn't hurt being familiar with them, getting comfortable with them, conceptualizing computers in terms of what is presented to you. Like, this is what a computer is. So, you know, these multiple generations of students who are growing up using Google Docs in school and using Chromebooks, maybe they're conceptualized Chromebooks as the equivalent of the crappy Apple IIs that are crappy computers they would never buy for themselves, that are pieces of junk that are managed by the school and that they have to use for schoolwork. But they are becoming familiar with Google Docs, and they are associating Google with computing in a way that they used to be associating Apple with computing. You know, so there are pluses and minuses to being stigmatized as the computer I had to use in school. But I think if Apple cares about the education market at all, it should not be happy to have its unit sales be flat over the same course of time where a competitor comes from zero to squash them by a factor of four. Like, I don't think that's a good position to be in the market. Now, maybe Apple doesn't care and they're willing to just let that ride, but how many markets are we going to look at and say, Apple doesn't really care that much. It's not a big deal. Like, what does Apple really care about? Is it just phones? Because even in the phone market, they're still making all the money and selling lots of phones, and I think doing a great job with their phone hardware, but they're also getting their butt kicked in unit sales there, you know, by an increasing percentage by this larger, more open platform. So I don't know what to think. Apple stock is way up. The iPhone is awesome. Everybody loves it. I love it. But when I look at education or the pro markets, maybe it's just nostalgia for the Apple that used to be. But boy, things have sure changed.
I feel like both education and the pro markets are places that you go when you don't have the consumer market. They're kind of they're these nice like holdouts that if you can get market share there, you can have a reasonably sustainable business, even if you have lost or you never even gained ground in the consumer market. And so when Apple was doing poorly in like the 90s and stuff, they retreated to those markets because with education, you know, and pros to some degree, like there's like there's special needs, and you can deploy a sales force tactically to like, you just need a relatively small number of very big sales to succeed in these markets, and that's not necessarily easy to get, but that's easier than convincing the entire consumer shopping public to buy your stuff if they aren't already interested in it, you know. And so, you know, Apple, I feel like Apple went to these markets not because they thought they were especially important necessarily for things like, you know, oh, your kids are going to use what they are familiar with, but because they were the only ones willing to buy Apple stuff for a long time. And now that that's no longer the case, Apple is seemingly being more managed by numbers these days, which is unfortunate if that's true, but that is sure how it looks. And these days, it you know, because they are popular with consumers by so much that they can kind of afford to throw away less profitable market segments, that is basically what they appear to be doing. Regardless of whatever Tim Cook's vague statement of the week is about how much they still care about us, the reality is that schools are, especially these days, pretty hard to make money in. I mean, again, like Apple's heyday in schools back like in like the late 90s and stuff, that was also at a time, or you know, early 90s too, that was also at a time when technology was new and novel, and schools were getting all sorts of these funding grants for going and getting computers, you know, and granted, not every school, but there was a lot of like other people's money being poured into like, we need to get our kids in technology. And it was, I feel like it was probably easier to sell into that environment than it is now that computers are no longer new and cool. Now it's just a budget item. And now it's down to, okay, we really just need things to be cheap. And whatever's cheapest and easiest for us to manage, and again, cheapest, that's what we're going to go with. So I feel like the conditions are very different now, that both Apple needs education and pros less than they used to. And also in the case of the education market, I think now is significantly more price driven, specifically with regard to computers, than it was 20 years ago, you know, back when these things were new and there was all this grant money coming in.
I think it was always tight for schools. I don't think it's that much of a difference. Like I would probably agree that schools are not as well funded as they used to be, but I would disagree that price consciousness is a new phenomenon when it comes to computers in schools.
Well, and again, that was also back in the 90s too. I feel like the difference in price was not as big. Like, you know, these
back
days
in the 90s, you're killing me.
These days, like the difference in price between a Chromebook and a MacBook Pro or a MacBook Air, it's like four times. Like that's a massive multiplier. Like you can literally get like, depending on the model of Mac that you select, you can get like 4 to 8 Chromebooks for the same price.
And it was worse when your choice was a Macintosh SE or an IBM PC, believe me, or a PC clone, Gateway 2000 or Mac SE, Gateway 2000 or Mac 2CI. It was worse.
Really? It was more than like a 4 to 5x multiplier on the price?
It was terrible, and the numbers were all bigger. Don't you remember how much? I don't know if you remember how much Macs used to. Do you remember how much my Macintosh SE cost?
I wasn't there when you bought it. No, but I in the 90s, a decent PC was about $2,000.
All right, so I'm gonna do the calculation here.
I don't know. We spent like $3,000 or $4,000 at least. I thought on my beloved Pentium Pro 100 megahertz machine. It was a lot of money. That's not to say that all of them were necessarily that much money, because that was pretty cutting edge at the time. And, you know, it was dad that was buying it for himself, and I just never let him use it because I'm a jerk. But that thing was not cheap.
Yeah. Well, but, and you know, and schools wouldn't buy the high end ones usually. You know, schools, sure. they did have to be conscious of the budget, of course. But basically, my theory is basically that, like, not only was the money a little bit easier to justify spending on computers back then because they were so new and everyone wanted to get their kids computers, but also that, you know, now the price difference is so vast between them. And I don't think it was as vast back then.
It was for Macs. Mostly because Macs were so much more expensive. So the educational discount, the college educational discount for my Mac SE30, which again is not a color Mac. Color Macs were available, but this was not a color Mac. It was a monochrome Macintosh.
But was it still a high-end configuration?
It was more high-end than the SE or the Plus, which were still for sale.
Okay.
But still not, like, not color, which, again, was a big thing in schools, right? Which is the reason they would buy a color PC, right? So, 1990-ish, $4,300. In 1989 dollars, or 1990 dollars, that if we convert it to current dollars, that's $8,600 for a monochrome computer. No keyboard. No keyboard. The keyboard was $189 in 1989 dollars, and you had to convert that. $8,600 for one monochrome Macintosh, like the little iconic, like, vertical Macintosh thing. You could get a gateway computer for less than $2,000 in 1989 money. The price difference was just as big, if not bigger, especially because schools needed to have color. That's why they all had Apple IIgs's in them, because the Apple IIgs's were color.
No, but you just proved my point. Your price multiplier was like 2x, and I would also say that the gate would, like, to get a mid spec gateway.
But that gateway is color though, with a big color monitor. If I go with like the Mac 2 with a big color monitor, it's
not
much worse.
For under $2,000 in 1990. If that's a mid spec machine, it's going to be a little over 2,000. So you're roughly a 2x multiplier, which is very different from a 5x multiplier, which is basically what we have today.
We don't have exactly a 5x multiplier now, because they get educational discount on these things and they don't buy the top dollar MacBook. So I think that
I'm talking like $250 versus like
$1,200. They're not paying $1,200 for it, and they're also not paying $250 for their things all told. But anyway, if I was go to like the Mac 2FX, like a high-end computer that actually had color, which again schools wanted colors, it gets way, way worse, much faster. Like if you add a monitor, just adding the cost of the monitor to the thing, because you're just buying the Mac, but that doesn't come with a monitor and it doesn't come with a keyboard. The multiplier was worse for Mac versus PC than it is for Chromebook versus iPad, which is the real comparison you should be doing, not Chromebook versus MacBook Pro or something.
No, but I think that's the comparison Apple wants people to do. I think Apple wants to present the iPad as the competitor to the Chromebook, but in practice, I don't think it is. I think those are separate things. It seems like schools have a pretty substantial need for laptop-shaped things. You know, whatever form that takes, it does seem like, you know, obviously they do sell a lot of iPads in education, but that seems like it's almost a separate thing. Like, I think the laptop form factor has proven to be more popular in recent years than tablets in schools. And in that form factor, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest reasons why the MacBook Air still exists. You know, if you look at Apple's average selling price of the Mac, it's basically the MacBook Air, like, by a long shot. It seems very obvious that they sell, like, cratefuls of MacBook Airs. Like, they just sell a ridiculous number of them. But that really is, like, I think most markets who are buying Chromebooks as an alternative, it's an alternative to MacBook Airs, not to iPads most of the time.
I'm looking at the non-education discount. Turns out the non-education discount for the Mac SE30 was $4,000, but no hard drive. No hard drive for the $4,300 model.
What did it have? Like a magneto optical or just floppy?
Yeah, so the non-educational discount for the good SE30 that had an 80 megabyte hard drive and 4 megs of RAM, $6,500 in 1989 money.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
So that's the one. That's the one with the good amount of RAM and the big hard drive. Let's see what that one is. $13,000.
All right, so now we're getting into the modern multiplier.
Still no keyboard. Still no keyboard.
That's an extra $200.
Yeah.
So how much was a Civic in 89 or whatever year we're talking about here?
I got to think it was less than or around 13,000 or less than that. Yeah, they were
that's
very,
what I'm saying. It seems like it would be
ridiculously. It's only ridiculously expensive when you convert for old people. It's only ridiculously when you convert to today's dollars, because back then, like, you know, it was the old adage from like whatever that was in a PC magazine, the computer you want is always $5,000. And that remained true. But that remained true as the decades passed and, like, you know, inflation happened, right? So it was always $5,000. In 1981, the computer you wanted was $5,000. And in 2010, the computer, maybe if you're a computer nerd, that you wanted was $5,000. But that $5,000 was worth a lot more in 1981 than it was in 2010, right? So it just...
Yeah, it was a car.
Yeah. But anyway, Macs were astronomically expensive. I was always amazed when I saw them in schools. It's because Apple gave deep discounts. And, you know, so that $4,300 for... Because mine had a hard drive. The $4,300 for the good SE30 was an amazing bargain. But nevertheless, a tremendous cost. And my kids' schools these days, I see a surprising amount of desktop Macs still. Like, they're old iMacs, right? And then you see carts full of laptops, which are like Icebooks, right? Because that's around the era when they bought these things. The reason, everything you said about Apple is like, when you have a consumer market, who cares about these things? That's all true, except that Apple's image of themselves and the image of themselves that they project to the world still seems to include a lot of stuff having to do with education. Not that they lean on it that much, but I think they like the idea of showing students using these devices. And a lot of their advertisements for their modern hardware, granted, they may be pitched at like college students or whatever, but I think the company always presents the use of its products in education as something that they are proud of.
And yeah, but that could just be marketing, though. You know, like I mean, they're also very proud of people who can draw on an iPad and call that a creative pro, but that doesn't mean that they actually have interest in addressing more of the pro market.
But it means that they're not... what it says to me is they have not given up or are not abandoning that market. They're just not competing that well in it. And maybe that's okay. Maybe you just have a reasonable participation and don't really worry that like some cheap vendor is coming in and swamping you in unit sales, because you're still a player in the market. You're solidly second or third place among three players, even though someone else is selling 4x as many things as you are into the market. And so maybe that's fine with them. Maybe they feel like they have the high end of the market, they're getting all the profits, yada yada yada, but it doesn't seem like they're abandoning it, whereas I see fewer and fewer instances where they're showing somebody doing pro work on pro hardware. Because, you know, what would they even show them doing? I guess they can show them using Final Cut and...
They show them using Final Cut with the Touch Bar MacBook Pro with these two giant LG monitors behind it.
They did do that, but it's... I mean, like, even as far, you know, recent history of the trash can, their big demo at WWDC was to have people from Pixar using the trash can to do, you know, heavyweight stuff that basically, like, other computers can't handle this. Because it's just too much. Yeah. It's too much memory. It's too much CPU.
That was a long time
ago. Look at how this fancy new computer handles this. That, you know, that was their demo of like, this is pro hardware for pros, yada yada. And I haven't seen a demo like that since. I haven't seen an ad like that since from Apple. You're right. It's been more about like, look, this amazing laptop. You can edit 4K video on this laptop. Isn't that great? That's great and all. But if your laptop is never going to leave your desk, like, is that the best choice for your editing bay or whatever? Like a laptop? Maybe it is. Maybe that's Apple's vision of the computer, but it's a far cry from, look, let's sling around multi-gigabyte textures and paint on these models in real time, you know, with the Pixar employees doing that demo at WWDC. So,
I think my main skepticism here is, like, I don't think there is any strong correlation anymore between the way Apple presents itself and its products in the marketing events and videos and commercials and what they actually make. Like, I agree with you that they do present themselves as being, you know, as really being, you know, prioritizing education and creative people and things like that. It makes for a great video. It makes for a great commercial. It makes for great statements. And I'm sure that a lot of the executives actually believe that themselves. They sincerely believe that. But I think the actions and the results of the company say otherwise. They really do say that, you know, that they are totally fine pricing themselves out of education to a large degree and ignoring actual pro demands when they don't line up with what Apple wants to do for the consumer market.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the trash can Mac, because just today, one appeared at my desk, not for me to use, but just to share. And it turned out we had just bought it just in the last week or two, because we have a guy on staff who's a video editor. And apparently the dual GPUs were enough to sway the IT folks to get the trash can rather than just an iMac 5K.
Did they do any research on it?
When the new iPhone comes out, be sure to show him your Geekbench score on your new iPhone 8 is higher in single core than that Mac Pro.
I know. I wasn't involved in any of this. You know, it just showed up all of a sudden, but I thought you two would be amused that we bought a trash can within the last week or two.
That's so sad.
Sorry.
Oh, I can't take it anymore. Just please, Apple, please fix this.
I mean, the last thing that I want in the entire freaking world is a new Mac Pro, because I might as well just retire from the show for like a month.
No, because that's the thing.
It's going to be nonstop.
If they keep not making one, we're going to keep talking about it. If they release a new one, then we'll talk about it for like 2 weeks, and then you won't hear about it for like a year and a half.
Until we start worrying that they're never going to make another one again.
Exactly.
Which will be about 4 weeks. But you know, what I was going to say was I do not want to talk about it for another, you know, 4 weeks if they do finally announce one. Or God forbid they announce one that is called a Mac Pro, but is in reality just a iMac 5K +++. The last thing I want is for that to happen. So I have to hear you two, you know, go on and on and about it forever. But even I am at the point that I'm like, come on, Apple. Really? Really? This is still a thing? Come on. You're better than this.
Thanks for our three sponsors this week, Away, Squarespace, and Pingdom. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
You know, I was speaking of another yardstick of seeing how into education Apple is. Not that I'm saying this is the best idea in the world, but a thing they used to do is they used to make special computers just for education.
The EMAC.
They were spec'd, they were designed and spec'd and priced differently. Sometimes regular people couldn't even buy them. Sometimes regular people wouldn't want to buy them, you know. But they, as a means of competing in what has always been a very price-sensitive market, they were like, we need to be able to sell into education. None of our existing, eventually they learned, like none of their existing computers, especially back in the day when every computer that Apple made was better and more expensive than all the other ones. They made special versions of computers and special entire computers just for education, to suit education's needs, whatever those may be. That showed, I think, a more serious dedication to the education market. Again, whether that was the best idea to make these special models, but, or they should have just changed their other models so they were suitable for education or whatever, that's farther than today's Apple seems willing to go. And on the flip side, I think, I don't know if this was in this New York Times article, but I've seen it bounced around. Maybe Gruber talked about it, that Apple is doing much better in IT recently, mostly because I think the Cold War against Macs in corporate environments has thawed over the past, I would say, decade or so. It used to be like, you're not even allowed to bring your Macintosh from home and connect it to my network because I'm the evil corporate IT guy and the whole world's going to end if you do that, right? To today, where I think most people joining a company have some expectation that there's a chance that they will either get to choose between a Mac and a Windows PC, or just everybody's using Macs depending on the company. I mean, look at IBM. They got thousands of them, right? Who would have thunk it, right? And the Macs integrate better into enterprise environments. That's because of efforts Apple has made. Both iOS devices and Macs integrate better into enterprise environments because Apple has changed their software in ways that enterprise people wanted, to make it more remotely manageable, to have it be compatible with various protocols. It's been slow and it hasn't been that dramatic, but the series of things that they've done have made Macs way more viable in enterprise than they used to be. Despite the fact that they're still pretty much enterprise unfriendly in terms of like how Dell will service and replace your things versus how Apple will do it and stuff like that. Like, they still have a long way to go. And it's interesting that they're sort of the same kind of, I'm not going to say half-hearted, but the same kind of Apple-style approach where we'll make some changes in your behalf, but we're not going to compromise our core beliefs about what a computer should be and how our business should run and so on and so forth, has yielded dividends in enterprise, probably because there is no equivalent to Google coming from nowhere and taking over the enterprise. They're basically just slowly trading market share with Microsoft and other Windows PC type things. Whereas in education, they've been doing things as well to try to make their iOS devices and Macs better for education over the years. But their pace of innovation there has been swamped by Google coming out with a product that is cheap, easy to manage, people like to use it, removes a lot of pain points that people have been experiencing, because the Chromebook, as we discussed before, is not just like a slightly better or cheaper laptop. It's not a netbook, right? The advantage they have is that it's a different computing paradigm with the, you know, things on the web, right? And that whole thing of, I've heard them referred to as dumb terminals, but I think that's a pejorative. They're not dumb and they're not terminals. It is merely a computer using local hardware to run applications and then using the network for state preservation. And it's a great solution, and it's easier for people to manage than installing software and all that other stuff. And that I think is why they're winning, not just because of price, because they could surely get trashed, you know, Windows PCs for something close to that price. But a crappy Windows PC is not as easy to manage as a fleet of Chromebooks, right? So I think, you know, there is no equivalent to that in enterprise. There is no competitor in enterprise that is making things 10 times easier, let's say, for enterprise IT than Apple or Microsoft or Dell or whatever, whereas there was an education. So I, rather than framing this as a failing of Apple, I think it's more fair to frame it as a success for Google. Let's give Google credit for finding one environment into which it can sell its hardware that apparently loves it. Because it's not the consumer realm. Didn't they just cancel the Chromebook Pixels? They're not making them anymore.
Yeah.
Consumers not so much, but schools love it, and you know, kudos to Google. Apple could have done better, yes, but and so could have Microsoft. But bottom line is, Google made a product that education loves.
John, how much did you say your 1989 Mac was? $8,000
in today's money?
No, in that money.
It was like $4,300 plus the keyboard.
So you would need another half of a Mac to get a 3-door Honda Civic hatchback 4-speed, which was $6,385. Almost, John. Almost.